So how are you doing? Does it feel like a long day? It's okay. Long day. In the first days of the metta retreats I did could feel like quite some hard work at times. But it's worth it. But maybe you don't know that yet. That's kind of the problem in the beginning. I, for many years, I began with Vipassana practice, and for many, many years, I was somewhat reluctant or even resistant to take an intensive metta or a loving-kindness retreat. And I didn't know it was hard work in the beginning either. I just kind of thought, I'm really into liberation, wisdom practice. That's what I'm practicing for. And to cultivate a state of heart and mind, even one as beautiful as loving kindness, I thought from my limited, really ignorant understanding, I thought, well, that's nice and all. And, you know, I could use loving kindness, and probably the people that know me would appreciate it even more. But it's not really where my heart felt or where my interest was pulled, you know. It's about liberation. And I thought that this would be like a nice kind of a sidebar, you know, something that would help us feel better, but kind of not quite to the point. So obviously, I don't feel that that's true, or I wouldn't have been doing retreats and helping, supporting to teach loving kindness retreats. It was actually a big surprise to me when I finally did one. I mean, I decided, yeah, I'll just do it 100%, 7, 8 weeks. And there's so much freedom and wisdom and understanding of the deep nature of our lives, of mind and body, of the way things are, that just arose without looking for it, without trying to have insights, just by simply doing this simple, straightforward practice that we've been doing here. Not investigating, not trying to look for anatta or impermanence or anything. Just coming back to the phrase and the metta again and again with more and more understanding. And the truth of how things are pops up in different ways. But it's the same truth that shows up in our insight or Vipassana practice. In all four of the Brahma-viharas that we've spoken of, the loving-kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, equanimity, all considered boundless or limitless states of heart and mind that mimic or partake of the lack of the fact that there's no separate independent existence, that we're all interconnected isn't even exactly appropriate because that sounds like two separate things connected, but really it's more non-separation. And this is what metta, that quality of heart and mind, at times, not every moment, but at times, it partakes of this truth and it opens us to experiencing our non-separation in various ways over our whole practice, over our whole life. It's really the wisdom of the non-separation that underlies our seeming separation and loneliness. So he says, not perhaps our habit of response to ourselves, something we don't like or like, to another person, to a situation. It's not necessarily our normal habit. It can be that we respond more out of protectiveness, of fear or aversion, or keeping ourselves separate from the difficult, or, you know, thinking we need to have the pleasant, all of that. But the thing is, what we start to see through metta, as we see through insight practice, that these responses of fear, of greed, of aversion, of trying to protect, are arising from a mistaken perception, our mistaken understanding of how things truly are. And in a moment, just in a moment, when we're recognizing accurately, when the heart mind's recognizing accurately, metta, friendliness, non-judging, is the natural response of an awakened heart mind. I'm just talking a moment of awakening. Don't think you have to wait till it completely awakened in 17 lifetimes from now. A moment of awakened heart mind, when our mind, our heart isn't clouded, isn't distorted by fear and aversion and greed. When there is accurate recognition, the response is just normal. I want to read this from Bishop Desmond Tutu, you know, the South African archbishop, very well known for metta. He wouldn't use the word metta, but love and compassion and forgiveness from all the stuff that went on in apartheid. It's a little bit long, but just so you know, this isn't like some concept the Buddha came up with to kind of draft onto something that isn't true. Bishop Tutu. We are wired to be caring for the other and generous to one another. We shrivel. Do you know shrivel? Like you kind of shrink up like an old prune. We shrivel when we are not able to interact. And this is the reason why solitary confinement is such a horrendous punishment. So the concept we have at home in Africa, he says, is the concept of Ubuntu. It says a person is a person through other persons. Ubuntu says that when I have a small piece of bread, it is for my benefit that I share it with you. Because after all, none of us came into this world on our own. And you realize that in a very real sense, we are meant for a very profound complementarity. You know, that's probably the same word in German, right? When I ask, it's always the same word, complementarity. It is the nature of things. You don't have to be a believer in anything. I learned to be a human being from other human beings. We belong in this delicate network. It is actually quite profound. Unfortunately, in our world, we tend to be blind to our great connection until times of great disaster. We find that then we start caring about the people in Timbuktu, or I'm adding Syria, or Rakhine State, or people in the flooding in Bangladesh when something's going on. We suddenly care about people whom we've never met, and we are probably never going to meet this side of death. And yet we pour out our hearts. We give resources to help them because we realize that we are bound up together. We are together and can only be human together. So this sense in the way he put it, and I was reading something about this last fall with a colleague who's a Buddhist monk from Uganda. And later after he said, Carol, Ubuntu, exactly. That's exactly the way we look at the world in Uganda. And so it's different language, but it's really not just a nice idea. That's the difference. A nice idea that we're all connected and we're all one. And the idea is one thing, but the knowing it in our gut, really recognizing this is how things are, is another, right? So we start where we are, and maybe this isn't exactly the way you experience the world and yourself all the time. But it's true, and it has enormous power. As is mentioned often in the suttas of the Buddha, Fred read one today about how powerful the Buddha talked about the cultivation of metta is for our own brightness of mind, for our own wisdom, for our own waking up. When one really understands, not intellectual understanding, but knows in our gut, even momentarily, that this lack of separation is really how things are, that what hurts you hurts me and the other way around. When one really knows this and can then actually respond, take one's refuge in the response of loving kindness, in the power of loving kindness and compassion, as the Buddha said, and as we can see at times in the world, it has an amazing power, stronger than the power of hatred and violence, although that may not be very obvious in our world. It certainly isn't obvious to me just when we're looking at what's going on in the news or who we know. So just a story, a couple that probably some of you are quite familiar with. You know the story of Mahagosananda. You know who Mahagosananda was? Oh, yeah. He was a Cambodian monk, a Buddhist monk. And during the time, I don't know if you remember, I don't have dates in my mind, when the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia, and they were Cambodians, and they basically decimated the population, killed millions of people. And Cambodia had been a largely Buddhist country at that time, a lot of monks and nuns, and basically destroyed most of that. As it happened, Mahagosananda, who is also a great scholar as well as meditation monk, was out of the country for some years studying at that time. And as it happened, I think something like 10 of his family members were murdered during that time. So he was definitely touched by it. So then he came back and couldn't get into Cambodia. But for some years after that, if you remember, there were huge refugee camps in Thailand and around the borders of Cambodia from Cambodians who had managed to get out of the country. And so the story of it, this is true, he came to the refugee camps. So he was one of the millions who were really traumatized, right? Their life was destroyed. Their family was destroyed in horrible ways. They barely made it out with nothing. And so when he got to the refugee camps, I mean, they were happy to see a Buddhist monk, well, most of them, sure, not all of them, but even if they weren't very devoutly a practicing meditator or a practicing Buddhist, at least it's a sense of the culture and a sense of someone who could bring some goodness. So what he did, and this is to me like, you couldn't just do this because you think it's a good idea. You have to really know this is true. But he went to, the center of the camps and formed like a little, you know, chapel or something, a little place where people could gather, where he could talk to them, maybe not exactly preach, but talk to them. And he just started chanting this from the Buddha, from the Dhammapada. Over and over he would chant this. And they would have recognized it, right? It's very well known. In this world, hate has never yet dispelled hate. Hatred ceases only through love. Or non-hatred is usually the Pali way. So hate never gets rid of hate. Hate is only dispelled through love. You too shall pass away. Knowing this, how can you quarrel? How could you know? You can't just do that unless you really know that it's true. And out of metta and wisdom and compassion, trying to share that knowledge, that wisdom with people traumatized beyond anything I could imagine, not to make them feel good, but because he really knows that to land in hatred and fear and respond from that and let that become the habit of our mind and heart is the surest way to increase and deepen our suffering. He knows that. So out of real love and compassion, that's what he shares. Incredibly powerful and rare, right? Because to really know that. But it's the source of the power and the strength behind the way Gandhi practiced, behind the way Martin Luther King could do amazing things. And so for me, I don't know it on that level. And there's many moments here in our practice we're not going to, you know, even be anywhere close to even having one feeling of friendliness. But for me, I'm saying this just to say this is not just a nice idea, this practice, to make us feel better, you know. And it may feel, just hearing this, it may say, well, that's great for him, but I know my cynical Western-trained mind can say, well, that's really idealistic. That's okay for him, but, you know, it's maybe irrelevant or weak in the face of what's going on in the world now. Or how can I possibly develop to that extent? So what's the point? You know, I better just hang on to my habits as best I can. Whatever we come up with, it's hard to know that. So, but if it's true, and if metta and compassion are the response of a mind heart that's recognizing things the way they are, okay, so then it seems like, why isn't it just natural? Why don't we just, why do we keep recognizing wrongly? One thing, this is from the Dalai Lama, because he puts things profound but simple. I really like, he says, somebody was asking him about why it looks like there's a real lack of caring and compassion in human society. And he says, well, perhaps we just pay less attention to compassion and caring. And by caring, I'm meaning metta here. We reinforce it less. In some sense, in our minds or hearts, we tend to fully embrace anger as an emotional state, fueling it or reinforcing it. If we were to give the same amount of energy, attention, and reinforcement to caring and compassion, they would definitely be stronger. So that's what we're doing here. We don't have to start out being Gandhi, you know. We're starting the whole form of this particular way we're offering this loving kindness practice is very much in terms of moment to moment, we're simply giving conscious attention to the intention, the motivation of friendliness, of metta. This practice, the way we're doing it here, is really a practice of, as I said, changing the habits of our mind, but through the power of intention. Intention, in the way the Buddha talked about it, and we can experience it, meaning that it's a mental, like, urge, the mental movement, say, in our mind that gives rise to action. It actually gives rise even to thought, to speech, to action. And in any moment, so there's an intention arising, you know, every moment. And so it would be kind of associated with or flavored by whatever qualities are in the mind giving rise to that intention. Excuse me. So an intention manifests in the quickest way, on the least energetic way, as a thought. And then as a speech, a little stronger, and then as action, a little stronger. So the way, just try to describe how this practice works. The way we're doing of just having a sense of yourself or the benefactor and repeating this simple phrase, may you be safe and protected. It seems like, you know, how many times have you said that today? You're like looking for something to happen. Are you safe and protected? Do I feel anything yet? Am I feeling, you know, that's extra. But the actual just saying that phrase, even if you don't feel it, but you're saying it not with, ugh, you're really trying to mean it. That's actually an intention. That's an intention of metta. And we think we're just saying it over and over, but what would your mind be saying otherwise? Would it be so helpful? I mean, listen, oh, I can't do this. This is the stupidest thing. My back hurts. I'm out of here. You know, whatever it is you're saying, I'm hopeless. This is stupid. This is boring. Metta, schmetta. I want to go finish watching. You know, those aren't intentions of metta, but they're intentions. They're showing us. And this isn't to judge. This is, we want to see what's really going on here. We want to be interested in it. If you're judging it, that's just more aversion. But you want to see, if I put down the metta, oh, God, I can't stand it. Oh, that's interesting. May I be happy and peaceful. You have a choice there. Which one are we going to take? May I be happy and peaceful. I don't feel it. Never mind. May I be safe and protected. This every single time. that just you simply allow the mind, the consciousness, the attention to drop into that phrase, even just in a neutral tone of voice, just not in a hating tone of voice, in a neutral tone of voice, that's cultivating the intention of metta. And it's not like we're going to see big fireworks going off or some big explosion of something. Because how much of our life has the habit of our mind and our thoughts been cultivating something else? And this isn't to blame ourselves. This is just to see how it is. You know, the very famous saying from the Buddha, whatever one frequently thinks about, ponders upon, or reflects upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. So we just, oh, whatever one frequently thinks upon, whatever is frequently running through the mind, that basically becomes easier and easier for the mind to think in that way. That becomes the way the mind tends or leans in moments of rest or even in moments of stress. So for whatever reason, and I don't know the reason, from the time we've been born through all the conditioning of family and culture and society, a lot of our conditioning has been, as the Dalai Lama says, to trust in anger or to trust in greed or to believe in the sense of separation that's actually being created moment to moment in the way our mind thinks about stuff in perception. So there's been a lot of conditioning, much practice to incline the mind in a different direction. So it doesn't mean there has still been many, 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 many moments of wisdom, of loving kindness, of compassion, of all these things in all of our lives, because it's a natural human condition. But all we're doing here really is taking the time and the energy, and it is some energy to shift the habit, to really start, as Ursula said, Ajahn Sumedho always says, to train our heart, to train our mind. The fact that it was conditioned, that we've been conditioned to respond in ways that bring us more suffering, well, conditioning is changeable. That's why it's called conditioning. The experiences that brought those conditions together are changing. They're changing now. Every time your mind heart lands in a phrase, it's shifting the conditions. It's shifting the habit. And Sharon Salzberg, who's been teaching metta for so many years, she really is kind of all of our guide in bringing it from the Burmese way this style is taught to the West. She says, I've heard her say so many times, she says, I'll go to my grave saying, it doesn't matter whether you feel anything when you're doing this practice. It's a practice of cultivating intention. And you're sitting there saying, I've busted myself all day here, and I've got more days to go, and you're telling me it doesn't matter if I feel anything? I don't think so. Okay, that's just a moment of greed. And then we go, yes, may I be happy and peaceful. We don't have to figure it out. Just have enough trust to land in the next phrase. That's all we have to do. That's all we have to do, which is actually a huge relief once you start to trust it. That first metta retreat that I did, it was probably 3 weeks before I trusted that. And in the meantime, you're saying the phrases, you're trying to feel it, trying to connect with myself, with the benefactor, trying to see the image, sending the phrases to them, trying to make them happy. I mean, it was exhausting. Exhausting. And then I would be shooting the phrases like, may you be happy, may you be, you know, and trying to make something happen or trying not to feel aversion, whatever. You'll probably have all your own ways of doing that. And then one day it occurred to me, oh, first of all, I don't have to do any of this. Second of all, I can't anyway. It's hopeless. You can't make it happen by an act of wanting it. Wanting is not the condition that allows metta to arise. I'll just tell you right now. The more you want it doesn't make it more likely to come. Wanting is actually the near enemy. Yes, starting to feel good. Come on, come on, come on. You can't do it. So all I have to do is relax back into this moment and let the phrase just arise in my heart. That's it. That's a huge relief. Ah, may you be happy and peaceful. That's it. You don't have to look around to see what's happening and nothing. You just say it and say it. And as you drop in, as you're more relaxed, as we're less trying, it actually gets rounder and fuller and more meaningful, and the metta starts to arise, just the simple friendliness by itself. So this is really the practice that we're doing here. I want to say a few things about the quality of metta. I think I said last night that it said that the immediate cause that's said in the Abhidhamma for the arising of friendliness, the state of metta in one's heart and mind in relation to yourself or a person, is seeing the good, seeing the wholesome. And that's true. Remember, metta is just, it's friendliness, it's patience, it could be called inclusion, non-separation, non-hatred. It's not necessarily a huge emotion, or sometimes it's not what we would call an emotion at all. It could just be the state of mind of being really connected, present, and open and accepting. But because it comes about at first through seeing the good, and as we are continuing with the phrases, the tendency of mind is it does start to perceive more beautiful qualities about people and situations than may have been the tendency of some people's mind. I mean, we all have different tendencies, but it starts to open up, to widen the field of perception. And because of this, though, some people, again, in the cynical mind, can get the idea that that means metta is kind of weak or one-sided or kind of blindly foolish, only seeing the good, you know, everything's all for the good in the best of all possible worlds kind of thing, going through the fields of flowers with a you know, fuzzy lens, holding hands, and everything is happy for the rest of your life. And that's how the movie ends, you know, we never have to see the rest. And as I was saying, like with Mahagosananda, that's so not true. It's actually just the opposite, that metta, this quality of friendliness, is the effect, the result. Even though we're seeing the good, it's not a false good. We're seeing the good, and then the attention, the awareness, the perception opens to include the wholeness, the whole being. It doesn't just stick there and pretend the rest isn't happening. So the metta actually sees more clearly than the cynical mind of aversion or protectionism as a kind of fear. In fact, the Buddha said frequently that when the heart, the mind, is obsessed or clouded with dosa, dosa is the Pali word the first texts were written in, that is usually translated as hatred, which is strong. But you can say any of the 10 million forms of negativity could come under dosa. Ill will, anger, aversion, impatience, whatever. And he said frequently, when the mind, the heart is clouded, is obsessed, is the word, with dosa, some form of that, we cannot recognize accurately. We cannot recognize our own good. We cannot recognize the good of another, and we cannot recognize the good of both. So even though when we may feel filled with anger or real clarity, this is right and I know what to do and I think I see it all clearly, have you ever had the experience of that when you're angry and then the anger goes away and you go, oh, I didn't see that part. I wish I'd waited before I hit send on the email. I mean, how many times have we done that, right? But when the dose is there, we can't see that. We really think it's true. Well, metta is the reverse. Because it's not coming in with a sense of bad or good, it's just it's seeing the good and saying, oh, it's like this now. It's accepting. It's friendly. It's non-judging. Simple example I mentioned the other night, I think. The example I always use in my own mind for how natural friendliness is or acceptance or kindness is if you go outside and see two little puppies or two little children playing. Just not loud, not being obnoxious, not giving you a headache, just, you know, playing. And you're not in a really bad mood. So you have an ability to let it in. So that's metta, that's friendliness. But it doesn't get in the way of discriminating wisdom. We can see really clearly if the kids are playing here and they start to run out in the street, you don't go, aren't they cute, the little kids? And you go and you bring them out. It's obvious, right? But at the same time, you're still feeling metta. You don't hate the kids for running into the street. You know, you don't think, oh, they're so bad. They're such rotten kids. We hate them. But that's what we tend to do without the friendliness of metta. We see something wrong or bad or that we don't like about someone, or as you may have been discovering if you didn't already know about yourself, very strong, right? And that one thing becomes like a box we put ourselves in or we put the other person in. Have you noticed that? You're really, when something in your, did anything come up in yourself today that you didn't feel totally in love with? Anything that you found your mind got a little bit negative about? And isn't it, I mean, maybe it didn't, but how that can take over at the moment and it's like, I don't know what, say you're deciding you're just not a good walker. Everyone else is walking. Something's stupid. I'll say something's, maybe that was somebody's. Okay, it wasn't stupid if you thought that. And that becomes the whole world. I'm such a pathetic person. I'm such a weak person because this one thing that's going on. You know, that becomes the whole. With metta, we go, oh, yeah, I can't really do this well. And look, here I am really committing to this practice to cultivate loving kindness. Isn't that lovely? Did that happen to anybody today? No. Keep trying. Maybe, you know, someday down the line you'll be able to. It does happen. And believe me, no one could be more shocked than I was when I first started noticing that happening. Really. It didn't even matter what the story would be, but the habit of mind to see what's wrong with aversion and identification and separation, and then the metta, oh, that's really painful. May I be safe and protected. Whatever's arising, we bring metta to it. Metta is not dependent on having a nice situation internally or externally. We bring them in and go, oh, that's really hard. Oh, yeah. May I be happy and peaceful. It was amazing because this is still hard. And the metta isn't, you know, usually, well, it's not, doesn't really matter because you're really a good person over here. It's including the whole thing. It's this lovely sense of acceptance and completion because you don't have to be any different at all from what you are in this moment. Metta just is like this now. And because that meeting of the mind, meeting the moment, in that moment of friendliness, back to what I was saying, that's the intention that's shifting, then that aversiveness that we're used to, oh, so bad, that just isn't there. And we can, in that moment, really experience what we're calling me, the whole different habits, in a more holistic and inclusive way. You don't have to divide up into bad and good. It's just called being human. It's really interesting to see. And then we keep with the metta, keep with the metta. It doesn't deny that habit, but the habit of the negativity does really start to lessen. We start to be able to see through it. We don't take it so much as God telling us, yes, this is really how it is, and everybody else in the world sees this as soon as they look at you. You go, oh, yeah, there's that, and there's this. And there's this really deep, wholesome intention to be happy, and whatever your motivation is, you come back to that, and it serves us. This is really training our hearts and minds. So metta is far from being limited or blind, or we only can see the good, and when bad stuff happens, forget it, let's go back to the anger. But it takes, you know, it takes practice here and in our life. It takes trust. And that's really what we're doing. Metta's more, in a lot of, I mean, it's quite profound, and when it's really touching the limitless quality, it's really very profound and striking and vast. That's true. But it doesn't only have to be like that. It can just be very simple and direct. So what I'm really, what I'm trying to get us to is just trusting the simplicity of the phrase. A lot of times the way we can get hung up in metta practice, because for sure, day in, day out, sitting, walking, eating, saying the same phrases, of course there's times it's boring and flat and hard to do. Of course it is. We're just human, you know, and that's going to be the case. And being human, and being that the habit of our mind is, well, let's look for something a little more interesting. Even if more interesting is a suffering story. Have you noticed that? Oh, just I'm bored, so let's think about this horrible thing that might happen when I go home, if this is going and that's a little more juicy, even though it's completely made up. But one of the things is we start looking for something, you know, more amazing in the metta, but looking for something outside of ourselves. You know, one of the reasons I don't like really to use the word love in connection with metta, why I like friendliness or kindness or even loving kindness, although even in English that's not a phrase that's normally used. Because love has so many connotations in our culture, right? So there's one is the looking for this huge love outside of ourselves, something to complete us. You know, that sense that, maybe none of you have this, but that sense of, you know, I'm not really enough in myself. And the sense of some love from someone outside, or just admiration, or just acknowledgement, or anything from someone outside of me to allow me to feel okay about myself, or complete. Or that can be a kind of love or metta, but it's not metta. Because it's actualized and it's strengthening this sense of internal lack, this sense of needing something else to feel complete, to feel okay. This is exactly the opposite of metta, the search for completion that feeds our loneliness, that feeds that sense of separation, me and other. And another way we get lost is, and this is again habit from the culture, of thinking that, you know, metta, friendliness, love, even for ourselves or from another being, can only come if we can somehow make ourselves better. You ever feel like with this going on, with this angry mind, with these things I did in my past, I'm not worthy of love, and we have to change ourselves to be better. Do you ever feel when something comes up in your mind, really, one of the really ugly things that comes, maybe I'm alone in this, and it's like this sense of, like you'd never want anyone else to ever know that that was going on in your mind. But under that's the sense of, I can't possibly be worth love with this going on in here. But instead, it's like, that's got nothing to do with it, you know? So with metta, we're just dropping into, again and again, the phrase, the metta, the friendliness, the clear seeing will arise of itself. And the way this practice is structured, very deliberately, starting from self and through all the beings, as Fred said, to all beings, is that to reach the point where the sense of friendliness doesn't make a distinction between beings. Yes, of course, this is like at the vast end of it. But we do get a taste of it. We're not saying, you're worthy of love because you did this nice thing, or you're an amazing person in the world. you haven't really done so much. I'll try, but, you know, you're kind of at the bottom of the pile. Metta's not about that, because it's just recognizing our non-separation, the fact that we're all human beings wanting to be happy. Metta's just an expression of how things are. It's not a grand passion. It's not something that, you know, we need to complete us. It's something that arises naturally in our own heart and mind, in our own consciousness, as part of being a human being, when we recognize accurately. We don't have to do anything different to deserve it. This quality, the willingness to continue to incline the mind, that's arising from wisdom. That's arising, there's some sense of faith, there's some sense of trust that allows you to keep doing it. And we're fortunate to have the support of others and the structure of a retreat, because it is hard to do alone. It is easy to lose the faith, to think, well, this is hopeless. I'm hopeless. Plus, I'm really tired, so forget it, you know. But here, okay, Abel, I'll sit here. Maybe you sit here for 15 minutes, and then you go, okay, may I be happy? May I be peaceful? Do you notice it can kind of sneak in? Just go, all right, whatever. May I be safe and protected. May I be happy and peaceful. And then suddenly, oh, yeah, may I be safe and protected. May I be happy and peaceful. You can hear the wholesome kind of wants to come in. The beautiful wants to come in if we give it space. And what's kind of far out is, at least in the way the Buddha describes it, seems true to me, when there's beautiful qualities in the mind, wholesome qualities, then there's not room for the unwholesome, for the suffering ones, and the other way around. But to start to see that metta or any beautiful quality brings the others along with it, it's very nice. So just a couple other things about the form of the practice again. As Fred mentioned, this is also the form of the practice where we just focus on self or benefactor or the being. We keep coming back to the phrases. We don't investigate what else arises. We let it come and go, and we just simply drop back into the phrases. This is a classic collectedness samadhi practice. So along with the cultivation of the metta, is cultivating a stability, a collectedness of the heart, mind, a steadiness on the object of metta. So that's why the instructions are different. We don't investigate. And it's why if you haven't done a samadhi practice before, but you have done vipassana, it can feel a bit bumpy, a bit awkward at first, as Ursula said about the walking meditation. That's fine. That's normal. Whenever we shift practices, we find out how habits of meditation are really strong habits that develop in the mind. And so you go, no, I have to investigate that coming up, that thought, oh, just come back. Oh, but the hindrances might get in. I have to investigate, just come back, you know. Well, maybe we'll say in the instructions, I won't say that. So how it works in the beginning, as I said, as we go through, there's difficult things will come up. Both we see what's in the way of metta, both through the collectedness practice, but just through the saying of the phrases. So if all we had to do was say the metta phrases, if we didn't have other habits in our mind, it would just zoom right in. But you may have noticed, as I've referred, sometimes the opposite comes up. Not just a little, oh, you're lost in thought. But sometimes, and it may be more in the next days, you might hit into some real self-aversion or real anger or sadness or the opposite, a real just get lost in wanting. Not just a little bit, I want a more comfortable seat, I'd like a piece of fruit. I mean a real like taking you over like the hindrances do. And we think, well, I'm blowing it. I'm supposed to do metta, and here's coming up all this anger, all this confusion. But that's one of the ways that this practice of purifying, of shifting the intention works. the habits that are kind of blocking our recognition, our feeling of the metta, at times they're going to be kind of lit up. They're going to come up. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with you. You're not doing it wrong. Again, though, if it's not too strong, we notice it. Oh, my God, I really hate myself. I mean, hey, this is strong. We don't investigate, even with the metta at first. Okay, can I just come back to, may I be happy and peaceful? There is no way. May I be safe and protected. You feel that. Oh, wow, that's really painful. May you be happy and peaceful. Just meeting that difficult moment with the intention of friendliness. You're not feeling friendliness, but the intention. That is the practice of metta in that moment. That is shifting how we're meeting these moments, even though it doesn't have a huge effect that you notice. Moment after moment, this is really powerful. These are one of the ways it comes up. Well, I will say it. There are times when the power of the difficult emotion, anger or greed or whatever, or just some memory, is so strong, you can't find your way back to metta. You don't even know. If you know at that moment, you need to shift into insight practice. I call it taking a Vipassana break. So say I'm just feeling waves of anger. Metta, I can't even say the phrases. But there's awareness. There's mindfulness. So just use your Vipassana, your insight. Bring mindfulness with the attitude of friendly. Oh, okay, anger feels like this. Feel it in the body. You notice the thoughts. You're letting it exist in the field of friendly interest, which is Vipassana. You're not trying to fix it. You're not trying to do anything. You're just acknowledging, here's anger. Bring awareness to it. And as it lessens, then you can go back again to the metta. And we'll talk about this in the instructions, in the groups too. One other way, though, in this form of practice, in the samadhi style, this is especially in the early days of a samadhi style retreat. At first, it might be interesting. I don't know if it was. But, you know, and really saying, bring the mind back. But eventually, because the attention's always being brought back to the same object, it starts to pale in interest. And there can be, and this might not happen, so don't go looking if it doesn't. But I call it like the mind starts getting into like a two-year-old temper tantrum rebellion. I'm not coming back to that, and you can't make me. And it just, not like a huge emotional thing like the habits of the reverse of metta coming up, but just, I'm just going to Bali and I'm going to hang out there for a while. And then I think I'll make a list of all the things I could serve at the next dinner party I have. And then I'll make an invitation list. Then I'll think about all the things I did in the third grade, you know, that were kind. And then come back to the metta. No way. There's no way. I'm not. Come back. Come back. You know, the example that used to be given for not getting, when you notice you're lost in thought, is like training a puppy. Do you remember that example? That was, oh, you don't beat the puppy. You pick it up. You put it on the paper. You pick it up. You put it back on the paper. Well, that's our little two-year-old mind. You pick it up. You put it back on the metta. You do it with metta. You pick it up. But as the mind is getting trained, the collectedness grows. It actually, and this is how samadhi, the collectedness of the mental energy works, it starts to collect around mindfulness of metta. And so this is why as the retreat goes on, it might get a bit easier. So the last thing, don't focus or look for results. This is so hard for us to trust. We're always wanting to see if it's working. But as I say, it's all in the doing of it, is how we meet the difficulties. And it's really just this very friendly face-to-face meeting. So I just want to end with this from the Dalai Lama. I like it because it just sounds to me a perfect description of the simple, direct meeting of metta. Nothing fancy, nothing esoteric, nothing outside of what's possible for us. He's just talking about when he meets someone. He's not talking about metta. But to me, it's like the simple way metta meets what's happening now. When I meet someone, the Dalai Lama said, returning to what has become an important theme, I always try to relate to the person on the basic human level. On that level, I know that just like me, he or she wishes to find happiness, to have fewer problems and less difficulty in their life. Whether I'm speaking with one person or whether I'm giving a talk to a large group of people, I always see myself first and foremost as just another fellow human. That way there is, in fact, no need for introduction. If, on the other hand, I relate to others from the perspective of myself as someone different, a Buddhist, a Tibetan, and so on, that then creates walls that keep me apart from others. And if I relate to others thinking that I am the Dalai Lama, I will create the basis for my own separation and loneliness. After all, there is only one Dalai Lama in the entire world. In contrast, if I see myself primarily in terms of myself as a fellow human, I will then have more than 7 billion people who I can feel a deep connection with. This is wonderful, isn't it? What do you need to fear or worry about when you have 7 billion other people who are with you? I just like the feeling of that. So thank you for your kind attention. We just sit quietly for a moment.